From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
One of the things you find out while you're in penitentiary is that everybody who's close to you, over a period of time, they're all going to fade away.
Today, we'll speak with producer of The Farm. It's nominated for an Oscar for Best Documentary about the Angola State Penitentiary, the largest maximum security prison in the country. Then, a look at a key UN agency which has solicited funds from global corporations with tarnished records on human rights, and the car bombing of Rosemary Nelson, Irish human rights lawyer and activist. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Northern Ireland's police force said today a probe into the killing of the Catholic human rights lawyer would be led by a senior English policeman because of allegations local police may have been involved. Police Chief Ronnie Flanagan told BBC Radio the decision was no reflection on his force's ability to probe the car bomb killing of Rosemary Nelson, who was 40 years old, as she drove away from her home in Lurgan, 30 miles southwest of Belfast yesterday. He said Nelson's family and the whole world should see that the probe into the blast, which was claimed by a pro-British Protestant extremist group, was completely open. The mother of three school-aged children, Nelson told a U.S. Human Rights Committee in September there had been threats on her life and that some of the threats had come from members of the Royal Ulster Constabulary. We'll have more on that story in just a few minutes. An ethnic Croat official in the Muslim Croat Federation government and two other people were injured today in a bomb explosion that wrecked his car, this according to witnesses and police. The blast occurred not far from the downtown U.S. embassy, but apparently was not directed at American interests. Witnesses said Jozo Latar, the Federation's deputy interior minister, was taken away with serious injuries. Croatian radio in Zagreb later reported that doctors in Sarajevo's Kosovo hospital said he was fighting for his life. U.S. warplanes today bombed Iraqi artillery sites in the northern no-fly zone imposed by the U.S. and Britain after being tracked by Iraqi radar, officials at the jets base in southern Turkey said. A spokesperson told Reuters the U.S. F-15E Strike Eagle warplanes dropped GBU-12 laser-guided bombs in self-defense, quote-unquote, on several anti-aircraft artillery sites northwest of Mosul. Amtrak's City of New Orleans passenger train rammed into a truck loaded with steel at a road crossing south of Chicago last night in a fiery crash that killed at least five people, injured more than 100. Rescue crews continued to search among the wreckage for about 20 people still missing as dawn approached today, 6 hours after the accident. In New York City, former Mayor David Dinkins, Congressmember Charles Rangel and 12 others were arrested yesterday as they staged a protest at police headquarters in Lower Manhattan over the police killing of Amadou Diallo. The demonstrations, along with acts of civil disobedience intended to provoke arrests, have become weekday ritual at one police plaza since last Tuesday, when the Reverend Al Sharpton led the first group of 12 protesters in a sit-in that ended with their arrests. Sharpton, who was also arrested yesterday, has vowed to continue the protests each day until the four white officers involved in the Diallo shooting are arrested. He said a total of 73 people have now been arrested in protests of the shooting. Women are expected to be able to file complaints to the United Nations for the first time next year on discrimination, sexual exploitation, and other violations of a 1981 international treaty. Patricia Flohr, the German diplomat who chairs the UN Commission on the Status of Women, said yesterday they'll finally be able to take their complaints and grievances to the United Nations in case they can't get remedies within their own judicial systems. Members of the Commission agreed to adopt an optional protocol to the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, which entered into force in September 81 after being adopted by the UN General Assembly in 79. It's been ratified by 163 countries, but not by the United States and some Gulf states. The treaty bars all forms of legal discrimination against women, demands equal access and equal opportunities in political and public life. Chechen President Aslan Maskhadov, under attack from opponents seeking to oust him from power, rallied 30,000 supporters today and said the breakaway republic is at risk of descending into anarchy. Chechnya has run its own affairs since Russian troops left in the end of 96, but no country has recognized its independence claim. Moscow insists that Chechnya is part of Russia, but has no means to control the situation there. President Clinton is kicking off a top-level conference on Africa today, a year after his history-making visit to the continent. Aides say he's determined to encourage progress toward democracy and open trade. Subjects include human rights, investment, agriculture, AIDS, and ending bloodshed in places like Sierra Leone, Congo, Angola, and Eritrea. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. A prominent human rights attorney in Northern Ireland who represented Catholics in several high-profile cases was killed yesterday by a car bomb. Rosemary Nelson was 40 years old. She died in the hospital 2 hours after the bomb blew apart her car as she drove away from her home in Lurgan, about 30 miles southwest of Belfast. The Red Hand Defenders, an outlawed anti-Catholic terror group, claimed responsibility for the attack in a call to the British Broadcasting Corporation in Belfast. The British government outlawed the group this month after a string of crude bomb and grenade attacks on Catholics. The force of the blast, which occurred just yards from the school where Mrs. Nelson's 8-year-old daughter was on a lunch break, ripped off both her legs and caused extensive abdominal injuries. Nelson had represented residents of Gervahi Road in Portadown in a long-running and often violent dispute with the Orange Order, a Protestant group that has insisted on marching down the predominantly Catholic road each July. Among her other clients were a man accused of killing two policemen and the family of a Catholic man who was beaten to death by Protestants in Portadown in 1997. She has also represented Protestant clients. Irish Foreign Minister David Andrews said the car bomb was very clearly designed to sabotage the peace process, quote, at this very critical time. Gerry Adams, leader of the IRA allied Sinn Féin, told a news conference in Atlanta that the bombing would make the peace process more difficult. He said all of that provocation causes tremendous anger within the nationalist community. He added, "I think that the killing has to be an incentive on political leaders to what we were elected to do." In Washington, White House Press Secretary Joe Lockhart read a statement from President Clinton condemning the bombing as a despicable and cowardly act by the enemies of peace and extending his condolences to Rosemary Nelson's family. We're joined on the phone right now by two people who knew her well. Owen Rogers is with us, president of the Irish Famine Genocide Committee, and Robert Bala, chairman of the Irish National Congress, a non-party organization that works for peace, unity, and justice in Northern Ireland. He's also an artist and was designer of Riverdance. He knew Rosemary Nelson well. Let us begin with Robert Bala. Tell us about Rosemary Nelson.
Rosemary was a very courageous lawyer, working in a difficult situation in the north of Ireland. She actually represented clients right across the political spectrum for many years, but when she became involved in representing some high-profile Republican cases, the loyalists who previously went to her for representation stopped doing so. So in the last couple of years, her cases have largely been from the nationalist community. Rosemary was aware for a considerable period of time that she was under some threat, and in fact complained to the RUC, the Royal Ulster Constabulary, who are the police force in the north, about harassment, intimidation and death threats, both from loyalists and also the RUC. And an investigation was set in place to examine these allegations, and a report, I believe, is due on that. Also, she represented the Garvahy Road residents. You mentioned these people. It's a beleaguered nationalist community near Portadown who have to undergo every year provocative sectarian marches through their area. Last year, a parades commission, which was established by the British government, said that the march should not go through their area. Since then, the loyalists have staged over 150 illegal demonstrations in the area. So this is a community under incredible intimidation, and Rosemary represented that community. So you can see that the amount of work she has done in upholding human rights was quite extensive. The residents of Garvahy Road also raised in a meeting with Tony Blair in London the question of providing some sort of protection or security for Rosemary Nelson. This was turned down by Downing Street. So I'm very concerned about this whole affair, one, a loyalist group who up to last week were very poorly armed. They had very unsophisticated weapons, and then suddenly they have a very sophisticated weapon which has tragically killed Rosemary. And also the fact that we've heard that the area where she lives was saturated with security forces on the night before her murder, and yet nobody seemed to see the murderers coming in to plant the bomb. So there are an awful lot of questions to be asked about this killing. Yeah. I think that this killing raises enormous questions about democracy. When a lawyer who works extensively for the upholding of human rights is murdered, I think this becomes an international question, and I think there should be an international inquiry into this callous murder.
Robert Bala, are you near where she was killed? Where are we speaking to you?
And I'm in Dublin, which is in the Republic, and Rosemary lived in Lurgan, which is just north of the border.
Mm-hmm. Owen Rogers is with us as well, president of the Irish Famine Genocide Committee, and I know you're on a cell phone, so I hope we can hear you clearly. You just spoke to Rosemary Nelson on Sunday.
Yeah, I spoke to Rosemary Nelson for approximately an hour on Sunday evening. And we were arranging for different speakers to come to a forum that our committee, the Irish Famine Genocide Committee, Riverside Church and the Brehon Law Society were sponsoring at Riverside Church. And she wanted to have another person called Deanne Hamill at the forum because Deanne Hamill's brother was kicked to death by a loyalist mob in Portadown, and she was representing the family on that border. She spoke about how she felt being isolated. She also spoke about her family, just a general conversation about life, particularly.
And how was she doing on Sunday night?
Well, she was very excited about coming to New York, but she really wanted to meet Father Michael Lapsley, who was one of the keynote speakers along with herself. And I was just, she asked me to send her a book about Father Michael Lapsley.
Yes.
And
Father Michael Lapsley being the South African priest who was also blown up by a bomb, a letter bomb, and wrote the book. Priest, had a book written about him, Priest or Partisan.
He was chaplain for ANC. And she was very excited about meeting him. And I had arranged that night also for her to stay in Brooklyn. And she was coming over with her husband and spending a week in New York. And I also arranged for a speaker who is involved in Dr. Gareth O'Connor, who is a specialist in the psychological effects of oppression, to speak in Garvahy Road in May. And I was supposed to call her yesterday, and so was Gareth O'Connor, to arrange the speaking venue.
In terms of Rosemary Nelson's level of hope, Owen Rogers, how did she sound?
I'm sorry, could you...
In terms of her level of hope and her feelings about what's happening in Northern Ireland and the peace process today, how did she sound?
Well, she was very concerned, particularly about what has happened in Gavahi Road. The marching season will start up shortly, and she was very concerned for the citizens of Gavahi Road and the peace process. You have to remember that David Trimble, who's the first minister in the north of Ireland, is the MP for that area. He represents that constituency. And he has refused to meet either the residence group or Rosemary Nelson. There has been repeated requests for him to meet them, and he has denied them all the time. And he is over here in America at the moment, and he's actually talking about equality when he won't even speak with the group or Rosemary Nelson. And I think he should be held responsible for this killing, as along with the British government, because I believe the responsibility lies with the British government and the British authorities, the security forces.
Robert Bala, your former chair of the Irish National Congress, which is a non-party organization that works for peace, unity and justice in Northern Ireland, speaking to us from Dublin. Can you tell us what the reaction has been right now in Ireland?
Well, I think there's a double shock. Sort of used to atrocities over the years, but for a human rights lawyer to be murdered, it strikes at the heart of democracy. I think people are appalled by this terrible crime. And that's why I say, argue very strongly that I don't think it should be just left to the RUC or the British police to investigate this. I believe it should be an international investigation, because in the past we feel we've always been let down by investigations that have been one-sided. And I mean, I don't think anyone in the area of human rights or democracy can accept the notion of the police investigating the police. It should be much wider than that.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for joining us. We'll continue to follow up on this tomorrow on St. Patrick's Day. Our guests have been Robert Bala, former chair of the Irish National Congress, perhaps most well known as designer of Riverdance, knew Rosemary Nelson well, and Owen Rogers, president of the Irish Famine Genocide Committee, speaking to us by cell phone in the New York area. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in just a minute after this music break.
Requiem, ate.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. On January 31st, UN Secretary General Kofi Annan spoke before the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland. He called on business leaders to join in a global compact of shared values and principles with the United Nations. 16 corporations have joined the UN Development Program, known as the UNDP, to form the Global Sustainable Development Facility. According to a UNDP press release, the purpose of the initiative is to fund investment projects to help poor countries meet social, environmental, and human development needs. Each of the participating companies is paying $50,000 to the UNDP, and other corporations have plans to sponsor the project as well. But critics of the project are concerned that the UN initiative has little to do with alleviating global poverty. Corporate watchdog groups say that many of the companies participating in the UNDP project have a poor track record on human rights, labor, and the environment, and that this project would help them improve a tarnished image. Further, critics believe that sponsorship would give corporations unprecedented access to contacts within the UN and government circles. Recently, Corporate Watch, which is a California-based human rights group, released a report that cites financial troubles at the UN and the U.S. failure to pay $1.6 billion in back dues as a pretext for soliciting the business community. And in a letter to UNDP Administrator Gus Speth, NGOs from around the world called on the UN to discontinue the Global Sustainable Development Facility. The coalition of organizations believes the independence of the United Nations is at stake. We're joined right now by a number of people to discuss this issue. John Kavan is with us, director of the Institute for Policy Studies, a D.C.-based think tank. Kenny Bruno is research associate at the Transnational Resource and Action Center and author of the book Greenwash. And we're joined by Professor Upendra Bakshi, former vice chancellor of the University of Delhi. We were going to try to speak to someone from a corporation that is sponsoring the UNDP program or from the United Nations, but we did not have luck in reaching anyone who would agree to come on. Let's begin with John Kavanagh, director of Institute for Policy Studies. What is your description of this program?
Well, this program that the United Nations wants to set up. Before I go further, I'm getting a lot of feedback here. I'm hearing myself speak. Amy, can you hear me okay now?
Yeah, we can hear you fine.
Okay, there you go. The proposal here is the UN, just to put this in a little bit of context, the great global agency set up after World War II, is now desperate for money. The U.S. has not paid its dues for a couple of years. We're behind $1.6 billion. And I think what is going on here is the UN, very much looking for new money, has reached out to a new source, one which many of us feel is a very dangerous source for the UN, and that is private corporations. And this particular UN agency, the UN Development Program, which is the leading UN agency trying to alleviate poverty, has proposed creating something called the Global Sustainable Development Facility. They've reached out and now have 20 companies who, for $50,000 each, are joining in a discussion. The pretext is, and this we don't dispute, there's 2 billion very poor people in the world, but this we do dispute. They are suggesting that by having these companies help pull these people into the market, they will alleviate poverty. And our concern, of course, is that the companies they've reached out to are companies with very bad labor, human rights, and environmental records, and who are using this facility, we fear, primarily to greenwash their images, to make them look good overseas, and also to get access to the UN's good contacts in developing countries. And it has nothing in the end to do with poverty.
Did this all begin with Ted Turner giving $1 billion to the United Nations?
Well, Ted Turner giving $1 billion did start a process whereby the UN took one step away from its traditional relationship almost exclusively with governments. It's governments that give the UN money. Ted Turner, nervous about the U.S. being behind on its dues, pledged $1 billion last year. And in a sense, that opened the door, but I think there's also been, ever since Ronald Reagan became president of the U.S., he has been the U.S. government and other governments have been pushing the U.N. to be much more friendly towards corporations. And so I think that this dance towards corporate sponsorship of a U.N. Entity began years ago. I think it's sped up, though, as the organization feels desperate for money. And also in a climate globally, as we all know, where the U.S. and other countries are preaching the merits of free trade and free investment and corporate involvement around the world.
Professor Upendra Bakshi, formerly from University of Delhi, vice chancellor there, now a visiting professor of law at New York University. What is your reaction to the United Nations Development Program taking this $1 million from corporations?
Well, our reaction is one of great and profound disappointment because this marks a further stage in the privatization of the United Nations system, a system in which, unlike some first-world governments, poor and developing countries' governments have systematically paid their dues with a view to advance common cause of humanity. And I think this particular experiment towards privatization of UN is a disaster because it means many things. First thing that means is that big corporations who have been comprehensive violators of human rights are allowed in a share of policy making without any accountability or responsibility in terms of maintenance of human rights. There should have been a possibility by which this money, if it was necessary in the first place to be raised, should have been subjected to certain conditions of what I call human rights responsibility by global corporations. And if this is not done, then of course what we have is a complicity or an acknowledgement that human rights have become obsolete even for the United Nations system. And this is a very tragic situation.
Kenny Bruno, you've written the book Greenwash, The Reality Behind Corporate Environmentalism. Can you go through some of the corporations that we're talking about that have each contributed $50,000 to this UN Development Program project?
Yes, Amy. Some of the companies are companies with tarnished human rights and environmental records. For example, Rio Tinto Zinc, which is a British mining company, is so notorious that it actually has a global network of citizen groups and union groups that are working to prevent them from continuing their abuses. Those abuses are from around the world, on all continents, actually. Asia Brown and Bovary is a Swedish-Swiss multinational, which it's an energy company. One of the things they're involved with is the Three Gorges Dam in China, which is going to displace about 1.5 million people. Another one, the American companies, Dow Chemical, the manufacturer of napalm, of DDT, of Agent Orange, and also the largest chlorine manufacturer in the world. Chlorine is at the root of some of the world's most toxic chemicals. And they've also reached out to Shell, which has not actually signed on yet, but is considering doing so. I think listeners to your program probably know about Shell's record and some of their activities in Nigeria, in the Delta area. And that Ken Saro-Wiwa and the Ogoni have blamed Shell for the execution of Ogoni environmental activists. So these are some of the companies involved. And you asked before, where did this start? These companies were also involved way back in the Rio Earth Summit in trying to, in a sense, take over the Rio Earth Summit and take over take the credit for environmentalism, for corporate environmentalism. And now we feel they're trying again to spiff up their image by associating themselves with the United Nations. And they really have to earn their good image and not just buy it for $50,000.
Is Citibank one of the
Citibank companies? Was one of the companies, and they've dropped out saying that they were too busy with their merger with Travelers. And Citibank, of course, has been involved with laundering drug money from Mexico and other things. But they have dropped out of the program.
Hmm. We're talking to Kenny Bruno of the Transnational Resource and Action Center, which is actually based in San Francisco, Professor Upendra Bakshi, former Vice Chancellor at the University of Delhi, and John Kavanagh, Director of the Institute for Policy Studies. Well, John Kavanagh, does this mean that this is a done deal, and where does it go from here?
It's very much not a done deal, which is why we're releasing the report now. The UN began discussions with corporations about a little over a year ago around this facility. And then, as you mentioned at the outset of the program, the UN Secretary General Kofi Annan launched a new piece of this whole initiative in February before business leaders, where he talked about a global compact with companies, but one whereby companies would respect worker rights, human rights, and the environment. We feel, we now have TRAC and IPS and the others who've been involved in this, have a number of groups around the world that have signed a letter to the head of the UN Development Program calling on him to stop this program. And our desire in this is not to hurt the UN. We think the UN is a vital institution. It's simply to say this is the wrong path to go down with corporations. If you really do care, as the UN does, the UN put together the premier document on human rights, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And I think many people within the UN, as they learn about this, will be very concerned about this direction. We think this facility can be stopped. It hasn't been created, and we hope that it can be used as an example of how not to create a working partnership between the UN and corporations.
Professor Upendra Bakshi, how did you get involved in this issue?
Well, I've been involved for a considerable time in issues of mass impoverishment. I don't use the word poverty, which makes it sound very natural. I use the term impoverishment because it is caused by policy choices that nations and global systems make. And I was interested in the notion for some time that is taking rounds of mainstreaming of human rights, by which phrase is probably meant taking everybody along, including governments, corporations, NGOs, and civil society, in the further realization of the values enshrined in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and other instruments of human rights. But one must make a distinction at some point or the other between a mainstream and a cesspool. And this is where some of us feel very strongly, forgive my strong statement, that going along with the same sources, which have such scant regard for human rights, is not fair. I have had 15 years of struggle for the victims of Bhopal, who were hurt very badly by Union Carbide, and still they have not received any justice at the International Legal Forum. So one does feel, looking from the standpoint of victims, and United Nations ultimately must serve the cause of the wider humanity, one does feel very strongly about this moves which are short-sighted and not properly thought out, and one hopes that they will not proceed further.
I want to emphasize that we did ask representatives from the UNDP, from BP Amoco, Royal Dutch Shell, Dow Chemical, Eskom, and Novartis, the bioengineering firm, to participate in the discussion, but they did decline our offer. Kenny Bruno with the Transnational Resource and Action Center, is there no place for transnational corporations in cooperating with the United Nations?
Of course, the private sector has to become involved and has become involved in world affairs. And, of course, they must respect human rights. They must protect the environment and labor rights and so forth. But the model that the United Nations Development Program has here is precisely the wrong way to go. What the United Nations should be doing is monitoring these companies, providing checks and balances on their power, and fostering some accountability for the companies rather than giving them their good name of the United Nations. And for those in the audience who don't know, the United Nations does have a very good name outside of the United States for the most part. For example, the Subcommission on Human Rights has a initiative that would do exactly that, which would provide more accountability for the behavior of these very powerful companies. But ironically, the United States is suggesting that that subcommission should be dismantled. So that's the kind of initiative we want to protect and we want to encourage, even as we are aiming to kill this Global Sustainable Development Facility.
Mm-hmm. Where can people go on the web if they want to get more information?
We have all the documents, including the leaked memo that we learned about, that you know helped us learn about this initiative, on www.corpwatch.org. That's corpwatch.org, and you can find everything about this, news stories, the leaked memos, the letter to the UNDP that a number of groups have signed, all on that site.
Mm-hmm. And John Kavanaugh, Director of Institute for Policy Studies, do you have a website?
We do. We put out briefs on global affairs every week at www.foreignpolicy-infocus.org. It's a program we do jointly with the Interhemispheric Resource Center in New Mexico.
And finally, what you think is the single most effective way people could be involved with this issue?
Well, if I could say, this is John, I think that it's time for people to get out and scream and shout and holler at the U.S. government to pay their dues to the United Nations. That is the single act that would most relieve the pressure for this. I also encourage people to call the United Nations Development Program and let them know that they think this is an inappropriate way to go forward with the partnership.
Do you have a phone number?
I have a phone number. Let me give you the IPS phone number, and from there we can direct you to people at the UN. It's 202-234-9382.
The United Nations general number is 212-963-1234. You can also get all the fax numbers and addresses at the URL I mentioned before, corpwatch.org. And we are encouraging people to support the UN, support the United Nations Development Program, support the U.S. paying their dues, even while we oppose this particular project.
Mm-hmm. Last question, Kenny Bruno. What do these companies have to do with poverty reduction? I mean, we're talking about the UN Development Program.
That's a good question. It seems most of them have nothing to do with poverty alleviation at all, and the UNDP's mission is to alleviate poverty. The assumption here is a very dubious one, which is that global markets and increasing shareholder value is going to bring the world's poorest people into the market and improve their lives. There's no basis for that assumption, but that's the assumption behind this program. And again, we need these companies to prove that they're able to do something and interested in doing something about poverty, and not just to say it and get their image burnished by that.
Well, I want to thank you all very much for being with us again. Kenny Bruno of the Transnational Resource and Action Center, also author of the book Greenwash, The Reality Behind Corporate Environmentalism. John Kavanaugh speaking to us from Washington, D.C., director of the Institute for Policy Studies. And Professor Upendra Bakshi, former vice chancellor of the University of Delhi, and a visiting professor of law at New York University. Professor Bakshi, I'm assuming that you don't have a website, is that right?
I don't as yet have one. But I do hope that every available means will be used to restore the United Nations to the peoples of humankind as against. And every attempt will be made to ensure that certain human rights responsibilities are accepted by corporations who would want to work with UN.
Well, thank you very much for your participation. And for listeners who want to get a copy of today's show, they can order a cassette by calling 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. When we come back, we're going to take a look at a movie, discuss a film that's up for an Oscar. It's one of the nominations for Best Documentary. It's called The Farm. 85% of the people who go there never leave. It's based on Angola State Penitentiary. It's the largest maximum security prison in the country. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in 60 seconds.
Press a man, where you gonna run to? Down, press a man, where you gonna run to?
the sea, but the sea will be boiling when you run to the sea. The sea will be boiling when you run to the sea. The sea will be boiling all along that day. You're gonna run to the rocks. The rocks will be melting when you run to the rocks. The poor rocks will be melting when you run to the rocks. The rocks will be melting, I said, all along that day. So I sat down.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. 85% of the people sentenced to serve time there will never leave. Angola State Penitentiary is one of America's most notorious and violent prisons, and those serving hard time are most forgotten by society, even by their families and friends. That is until a film portraying life at Angola in Louisiana was nominated this year for an Academy Award for Best Documentary. The Oscars will be presented this coming Sunday, March 21st. The film is called The Farm and follows the lives of six prisoners who are at different stages of their sentences. Viewers witness the arrival of a 22-year-old man who will serve a long sentence, attends a parole hearing for another who has already spent 20 years at Angola, records the last weeks of the life of a prisoner on death row before he's executed, and attends the funeral of a veteran prisoner after he dies of cancer. As more and more prisons are built from coast to coast, and as the United States races to become the country with the world's highest incarceration rates, doing time is a reality that one in close to 150 U.S. residents face. We're joined right now by Jonathan Stack, who's the producer, writer, and director of the movie The Farm. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning. Glad to be here.
So you're headed off to Los Angeles for the Oscars?
We're leaving tomorrow morning. I should also mention that I made the film with Liz Garbus, who was the partner throughout, and also Wilbert Rito, who's an inmate in Angola, was the co-director in the film.
Wilbert Rito, who is also the editor of the Angolite, the right. newspaper yeah. inside that prison that has gotten so much attention outside.
Yeah. And there's sort of an irony, I guess, and this year there were no African-Americans nominated for any of the awards, and the only one is Wilbert Rito, who happens to be behind bars.
Hmm. Well, right now we're going to turn to an excerpt of your documentary, and it's about one of the people that you profile. His name is George Witherspoon, and tell us a little about him.
George is an example of a person who did everything the system asked him to do, to reform, to rehabilitate. He went through all the right programs. He did everything you're supposed to do that they ask you to do in prison, and nothing came of it. He went up for a parole board hearing you get one guaranteed hearing. He had that hearing around 7 years ago, and he was denied parole, and he's been going back every 6 months since then. After that, you don't get a hearing unless the parole board unanimously grants you one, and he hasn't been granted one. But I have a little bit of news for people who have seen the film. Just to sort of give a little background, he's from Chicago. He went down in the early 70s. He got involved in a bank robbery, and he shot a police officer who survived, and then when he was down on the ground, he got shot in the face, and has been in prison ever since then in Angola. But he, I think this bodes well, and maybe, you know, a conversation we can have about the influence of the film. But one thing that's come about is that they've actually granted him a hearing on April 23rd, and all the indications are that this could be, you know, that the fact that they granted him a hearing is good.
So it would be strange. There was a time in the not-so-distant past when orientation at Angola consisted of a beating and the advice to purchase a weapon.
Oh, you're thinking about your backside.
Nowadays, the prison offers a full-day orientation led by some of the old-timers.
We got butters and all the penitentiary change people.
How many of you all are serving life sentences in here now? How many of you all are serving over 20 years? Okay, so the majority of you all are long-termers. One thing I want to explain, let me explain something a little bit about myself, and then you'll understand where I'm coming from. In January of 1972, while under the influence of LSD, I came through Shreveport, pulled off a robbery. It led to a shootout with police. Two police were shot. I was shot. My fall partner was shot. But nobody died. 9 months later, I was sentenced to 75 years in prison. I've been here since then. It's over 25 years. One of the things you find out while you're in penitentiary is that everybody who's close to you, over a period of time, they're all going to fade away. First, it's going to be your associates and friends, all your homies. They're going to cut you loose. Your old lady, she's going to cut you loose. Your children, a lot of you all who might have children now, as they grow up, they're going to forget that you're their daddy. Usually the person that's going to stick with you is going to be your mother, your father, maybe a close brother or sister. And as you stay down a long period of time, those people who do stick by you are going to get older and older, and sometimes they're going to die off. So you're going to be here alone. But one of the things I want to show you is that when you start going through those pains of finding out that the people you thought were close to you begin to cut you loose, don't get hooked up into the negative activities that can get you stuck here forever, despite the fact that you're doing life sins. There's always hope. All right, I'm gonna talk to y'all later. When I came, you know, like I say, Angola was classified.
And that was George Witherspoon giving an orientation to the new prisoners.
Yeah, every Monday, a new group comes in. They're brought up by bus, and as you mentioned before, 85% are get, you know, sort of statistically not likely to ever leave the place.
Describe Angola State Penitentiary to us.
It's kind of it's a world unto itself. It's way up in the corner, right on the Mississippi border, it's sort of surrounded on three sides by the Mississippi River, which curves around its banks. It was a slave plantation up until 1865. It was a prison leasing kind of prison up until till 1901.
In fact, it's named for the country where the slaves came from,
exactly,
Angola.
Yeah, it's just a place, it's sort of really a world unto its own. It's just kind of, you go through those gates and it's timeless. People are there moving at a very slow pace. Since everybody is serving a life sentence, it's just sort of stultifyingly slow and dreary and depressing, actually. And despite that, you just find some of the most incredible people who have sort of like, whose voices and just their energy as humanity comes out in just the most wonderful ways.
And what is the racial composition?
77% at this point, I believe, are African American, and the rest Caucasian.
And everyone is serving a life sentence?
Not everyone is serving a life sentence. What they have there is what they call, you know, virtual life sentences, which are everybody more than 50 years who statistically are going to die in the prison. There's a huge cemetery. And the sentences are getting harsher, or we should say that the chances of getting out have diminished over the years.
We're talking to Jonathan Stack, producer, writer, and director of The Farm, which is nominated along with four other documentaries for the best documentary that will be awarded next Sunday night at the Academy Awards. Now, among the people that you profile are a man named Vincent Simmons, and this is a case that you've taken an extended interest in.
Yeah, what happened was we just chanced upon Vincent. Actually, what we were hoping to do is film Ashanti, who was due to have a parole board. And we were kind of naive. We were wanting to film somebody getting out of prison. And his record looked so good when we read it. We thought, surely this man would get a parole and possibly get out. And he was even denied a hearing. And we wanted to film the parole board process. So we found out who was going to be there that day. And we went just that same day or a couple of days before. There was only three people. And Vincent was one of them. So we happened to be there in that parole board that day just by chance. And it was quite an incredible occurrence. And it's become sort of the most disturbing and most controversial scene in the film, because you get to witness the parole board in action, and you see that after 20 years of waiting, he spent 17 years filing to get these documents to pursue his case, and he has them, and he presents them to this board, and they've already made a decision. You see on film, they've decided, before he even goes in there, they've already rejected his case, and so it created a real controversy in Louisiana.
They hear from a woman who was a rape victim.
Yeah, there's actually two women. They're twins. Not everybody knows that, but they're two women. They come up one after the other, and they are... You know, they basically have been in silence for all these years, and now they come at the parole board to protest his release. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what happened was I was really disturbed, of course, by what happened. I decided to try to find out what took place in that town 20 years earlier. So I went back and I spent the last year, and I'm still involved in this, trying to find out really what actually took place. And I've just finished the filming in the last couple of days.
Well, this part of the farm, the movie that you made, is Vincent Simmons going before the parole board. The women have just gone before the parole board, and now he is brought in. He's shackled. He carries in his legal papers through the chains, and he starts to lay them out. And there are three members of the parole board. They have just said, basically, that they are going to find him guilty, though he doesn't hear that, and they start to talk to him.
The full name is Vincent A. Simmons. You were sentenced to 100 years of hard labor, and your maximum date is March 16th, 2077. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And you've been locked up how many years as of now, Mr. Simmons?
20 years.
20 years?
Yes.
Would you answer Mr. Magri's questions, please?
Yes, sir.
You committed these two rapes?
No, sir.
What'd you say?
No, sir.
Tell me what happened.
Well, I had newly discovered evidence because I've been trying to get the evidence since I've been here to prove my innocence.
You pled guilty?
No, sir.
Okay.
They told you, say that they wanted me to make a confession. And I told them that I wasn't going to make a confession because I was innocent. And they said one of the officers hit me. And when I tried to jump up, the other officer jumped up and he shot me in the police station.
Then your version is that they just shot you.
Yes,
Their version is you grabbed a pistol and you tried to kill them and you kept pulling the trigger and it wouldn't go off and another officer came in and shot you.
No, I was handcuffed when I was brought in.
I understand that, but you can still grab a pistol.
Yeah.
You know, you contended now you didn't grab a pistol.
I didn't grab the pistol. I was never charged with that crime. They tried to justify shooting me.
Suppose if the officer wanted to kill you, when he wouldn't have
shot you. He shot me right above the heart. Later on, I got out the hospital. They appointed me two attorneys. And they talked to me once, and then I went to trial. We didn't have none of this evidence. None of this evidence was presented before the jury because the DA had it in his files. And in these files, the doctor's report indicated that the girls were virgins because they were examined after I was arrested. You say, why?
You have those reports where the doctor said that they were virgins? I'd like to see them.
This is a segment of the film, The Farm. It's a 90-minute film, again, nominated for an Academy Award, will be considered this Sunday. And our guest is Jonathan Stack, producer, writer, and director of The Farm. And we're listening to an excerpt of Vincent Simmons' parole hearing. And he got it denied within minutes after he walked out of the room and then told to come back in.
Yeah,
done deal.
Yeah, it was that really sort of set the next film in motion. And that's been a really difficult project because I've gone back in and trying to get people's memories sort of cleared up from 22 years. And the film will be out. I'm not sure exactly when, but I think people are going to be really surprised by all the sort of twists and turns. But I really wanted to talk also about what we've been doing with the farm down in Louisiana, which is beginning to kind of shift, I think, the energy in the state in terms of how they're perceiving inmates. We've set up these town meetings, and now we've been through, I think, six cities so far, in which we bring together people from all different political spectrums and get them to. We watch the film in smaller cities, not in the bigger places, and people really participating. And it's just been incredible to see, like, what you can do when you get people sitting down who don't necessarily agree with one another, but at least are sort of like committed to some sort of change. And this has really been constructive. And as I said, one of the things earlier was that Ashanti was getting a parole board, and I just see a lot of things moving.
It's very tough for independent filmmakers. You run Gabriel Films in New York City. The other, by the way, documentary films that are up for an Oscar, Dance Maker, The Last Days, Lenny Bruce, Swear to Tell the Truth, and Regret to Inform. Is how you get these independent films out. And by the way, does the Oscars make a difference, just an Oscar nomination?
I think it does. I think it makes a difference in terms of how people perceive you and the opportunities to do future work. But, you know, this is no harder than doing any political movement or any kind of work. I mean, we're really fortunate, I think. You know, there are opportunities. It's not the easiest thing, but it's just like, you know, making change is not easy, and I don't feel like we're particularly burdened. I feel really grateful for the opportunity. It's quite an amazing thing to be able to go into places that otherwise you wouldn't be able to, and to like hear stories and share those stories in film and getting them out. You know, the film it's on cable television. This is going out on A&E. It went out last night, and it's doing really well. And I think it's disproving the sort of myth that Americans don't want to watch intelligent things on TV. I just think that they're not given the choices.
How did you end up selecting The Farm? How did you end up selecting Angola as the place, the site of your documentary?
It was really Wilbert, the relationship with Wilbert. I'd read his book, Life Sentences, and corresponded with him, and he was just somebody who's a very powerful storyteller. And, you know, it's just, as a filmmaker, you're looking for places that are sort of huge because they tell that bigger story, and it doesn't get any bigger than Angola, the largest prison in America, 5,000 men, and just in need of getting their stories told and participating, having their voices participate in the national dialogue, as opposed to the kinds of censorship which takes place almost throughout the country in prisons.
Needless to say, Wilbur Ito won't be at the Oscars, though he is the co-director Correct. Yeah. of the film, but he is in the documentary interviewing the man who you profile, who is on death row, who ultimately dies. In fact, he's interviewed everyone who's died at the penitentiary for the last
almost 25 years now. Yeah, Wilbert's he was on death row himself. He was released in 72 when the death penalty was declared unconstitutional for those few years. But he's an amazing person. He's going to be, apparently I'm told, he's going to be watching it in the warden's offices with Ashanti and a couple of the other inmates who are in the film. And, you know, I think this means a lot to him. I know, and in many ways sort of dedicate even the nomination to him and to all the people in Angola, and to thank them for letting us into their world.
And it's an incredible point you started with, Jonathan. No African Americans nominated for the Oscars this year.
In any category, you know, not a single one, only one, and he happens to be in prison.
Well, Jonathan Stack, I want to thank you for being with us. Jonathan Stack, the producer, writer, and director of The Farm, along with Liz Garbus and Wilbur Ito, and owner of Gabriel Films. If people want to get in touch with your film company, where can they call?
They can call at the office. It's 212-941-6200. Yeah, we're doing a lot of great projects. We're doing a sort of the equivalent of The Farm is we're doing now the women's prison in Louisiana and have started filming there. And it started around 4 or 5 months ago, and the stories are every bit as incredible as in The Farm.
Well, I look forward to seeing it. Folks, if you want to get a copy of today's program, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Maria Carrion and David Love. Special thanks to Jeremy Scahill. Our technical director is Errol Maitland. Our engineer, Bernard White. From the studios of WBAI in New York, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
Long time coming, but I know change gonna